Right. Just for Pumi this morning. Here we go. I knew you'd like it. No more. All right. Good morning, everybody.
Oh, we haven't started the morning like that in a long time.
It's about time. So here we are. It is a live broadcast of this morning's election special burning platform. Don't panic, though. We're not going to be sitting here like those TV anchors filling time between the tiny little drips and drabs of election results that are pouring in. We're going to be giving you a whole lot of other stuff as well. Pumi has just got back from Israel. So first of all, Pumi, I had to put up with an angry audience who were pissed off that you weren't there last week. Where's Pumi? We don't want to hear you talking shit, they said to me.
I don't believe it.
No, really. So I was like, okay, don't worry. She'll be back. She's just in Israel on a fact-finding mission. She's going to bring us all the latest. And how was your trip?
It was hectic. It was hectic because the country is at war. It was my first time in Israel, but we had and some of the people that were with me on the trip, some people would have seen, like Pumlani Majozi and all of that kind of stuff. And it was incredible. I couldn't have imagined what it looks like on the ground, a country at war. We were in the south. We were in the north, down south near the Gaza border, up north near the Lebanon border. We spoke to lawyers and analysts and defense, and it was incredibly mind-blowing. We had a rocket incident. We had to get into bunkers because there were rockets being fired in one of the areas we were at in the south. Rockets being fired into Israel. You would have seen a couple of days ago about rockets going into Tel Aviv, as far as a place called.
It's not going to make a lot of difference to the average South African who doesn't know the map as well as that. But
yeah,
you did go and see the actual site of some of the events of October the 7th. Now, that must have been kind of a bit jarring and harrowing, because there's still people in some parts of the world, including here in South Africa, who just don't believe anything near that level of barbarity happened on that day. So tell us from your own very objective point of view, like what it was like to see things that only happened a few months ago, but which precipitated this war, which is now raging in that area.
So first, I think first I want to say the one thing about the Jewish people and the Jewish culture, because it's not necessarily religious, right? So culture is they have got 2,000 odd years of history keeping. And what I mean by that is that, you know, whether it is in their religious rites around Easter, what we call Easter Passover, where they're remembering the leaving of Egypt, da 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 da. The Holocaust, you've seen Holocaust museums. There are Holocaust museums around the world. They have a history of knowing how to hold memory, particularly memory that is significant for them and for their history. And that is what I also saw in this tour. We went down to the site, you know, where the Nova Festival was, where one of the biggest atrocities. And that site, even though it's still kind of an alive site in terms of there are people who are still being held hostage in Gaza. So there's people who've got memorials up for their young people, because it was a festival. You know, it's kind of like being at bushfire and then being ambushed. And kind of, and the memory and the holding of that memory and not allowing it to die or go away, I think is definitely something that they have got right, that they're doing right. And there may be people who don't believe that such a thing happened. It's in your mind, it is actually unbelievable. And when you are there, we also went down to one of the kibbutz that was hardest hit. And this is what was so mind-blowing for me. In that kibbutz, they had 400 people living in that community. At the end of the 8th of October, 124 of their number had either been killed or taken hostage or hurt. That's a quarter of your population. So if you think about yourself, Gareth, in your complex where you live, if you think about a quarter of that population being ripped out of your community, that's what that is like. It's harrowing. It's harrowing and it's mind-blowing. And it's a live war scene. So you are sitting in meetings. When we were up, I just forgot the name of the town we were in, which is near the Lebanese border. Mm-hmm. It sounds like thunder, but you can hear the bombs dropping. They have an app. You know, we've got Eshkom Sabush so that you know when the load shedding is. They have an app, so you know where the rockets are. You can choose up to 10 communities that it will keep you live on in terms of what's happening in those areas. It's harrowing. Imagine living like that.
No way to live. But you did get to meet, obviously, when you go to a country like that, you also get to meet fascinating people. And you managed to recruit such a person for our show for this morning, which is terrific because we can talk about other things and get to our election results. Only 0.94% complete, by the way. So not even 1% of the election results are in yet, but they're starting to show some very interesting things. We'll get to those. And I know that's why a lot of people have joined us this morning. But I do think it's probably important to pay attention to international things. And there isn't a more important international event than what is happening in the Middle East at the moment. So
for me, I think it's the fact that it is a rapidly developing story. Almost every day, the new facets of the story that are coming out, new activity, new action, the criminal court activities, the ICJ activities, which we South Africans have been watching. I think a lot of South Africans have been watching because of South Africa's particular involvement. I met a really fascinating young man who is actually a UCT graduate, so one of UCT's finest, who is now living in Israel and is an international law expert. And David Benjamin, is he on the other side?
He is. He's here. Here he is.
Yeah.
Hi, David.
Hello, David. It's good to see you.
You know, it's early morning here, but of course it's even earlier in the morning there. But I think when you introduced me, you said young man.
And I'm yes. thinking, wow.
You've made my day already.
But David joined us for a dinner in Jerusalem, in a fabulous restaurant in Jerusalem. The food, guys, I overate. As you can see, there's significantly more of me this morning than there was 2 weeks ago. But some interesting conversation and even more interesting insight into some of the things that are developing in the Middle East, particularly in the legal spectrum of it. And that's why I thought David would be a wonderful person to join us this morning. And I think first off the bat, David, I think for some of our listeners who may not know the difference between the ICJ and the ICC, shall we start at the basic and run on from there?
Yeah, sure. Okay, so the ICJ is the International Court of Justice. It's an organ of the United Nations. It's actually mentioned in the UN Charter. And it's the court of the world, basically. Mm-hmm. But the procedure in the ICJ, which everyone has been following, of course, in South Africa in particular, is a special procedure under the Genocide Convention. It's an international convention which most of the world is signed up on, including Israel, South Africa, many other countries. for the prevention of genocide. And there's a clause in that convention which refers any dispute between countries on an issue relating to the existence of a genocide or the prevention of genocide, that is under the jurisdiction of the ICJ, of the International Court of Justice, which sits in The Hague. So what everybody's been watching lately is a procedure there in the ICJ. The ICC is the International Criminal Court, something else entirely. It also sits in The Hague. Maybe that's confusing. It's a much newer creation. It started out in 2002. And the idea is that would be, a world court, but a criminal court which would try people, suspects for war crimes and crimes against humanity. The ICJ is not a criminal court. The ICC is a criminal court. The ICJ is just supposed to regulate disputes. The ICC can actually put people on trial and order their incarceration, at least potentially. So very different types of court.
And now, you know, I think that the thing that's different about what we are watching with South Africa and Israel in the ICJ is the fact that this is supposed, it's a court that is a dispute between countries. But now Hamas obviously is not a country. And that's why they are not party to this particular case. And it is only Israel that South Africa has brought in front of the court. And last week, there was an additional ruling. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that ruling before?
Well, it's interesting because you say Hamas is not a country. But most of the countries in the world have recognized the existence of a Palestinian state, which I would take issue with, of course. But certainly from the point of view of the ICC, they recognize there is a state. Say Hamas is not a country, then what is it exactly? But no one's really holding Hamas accountable or expected to be held accountable in any way. Also, of course, to a large extent, it's nothing to lose. For Israel, it has a lot to lose. Its international reputation, its diplomatic standing, its relations with other countries. Very much this is on the line in the ICJ proceeding, because most countries in the world support the ICJ. They want the ICJ to continue operating. It serves an important function. And to be in a situation where there's some kind of tension or contradiction between supporting the ICJ and supporting Israel, you know, the concern for Israel is that people will go down on the side of the ICJ, which can be, you know, quite devastating for Israel. I won't say Israel can't handle it at the end of the day, but very, very detrimental to Israel in many, many aspects.
But David, can I just ask, because these are all supranational bodies. These are bodies built up to run an international government that not everyone has opted into. And we know full well that the US and many other countries, Russia, don't have any interest in being part of the ICJ and having any of their rulings apply to them. They don't view these as important at all. So when we talk about the majority of countries recognizing Hamas, or the majority of countries sitting on tenterhooks waiting for the ICJ to tell them something, I mean, I don't think that's the case at all. It's a few bureaucrats here and there who are particularly interested in this, some people who think that there's some form of global agreement on how these things should operate. But they were set up without the mandate of the populations of the countries who purport to be setting them up for them at the UN. And even the UN's sovereignty and ability to make decisions about major international events is being called into question now. And surely this situation in the Middle East, if nothing else, tragic and ugly as it is, and it's viewed as tragic and ugly by everyone in the world. There's no one who's going, yay, this is terrific. It is bringing to the fore whether or not institutions and organizations that are offshoots of an international collective, an agreement by association, whether these things should actually have any weight in the world. I mean, we've seen endless amounts of hypocrisy from the UN, from the ICJ, about not prosecuting X and Y. We even had a very famous case of Omar al-Bashir coming here to South Africa, a known human rights violator and someone who's responsible for atrocities all over Sudan. Nothing happened to him. I don't think I can remember in my living memory any successful prosecutions by the ICC of any real import, with the possible exception of Slobodan Milosevic back in the Balkan Wars. But other than that, this is a very higgledy-piggledy thing. It seems random. It seems full of hypocrisy. And it doesn't really carry the aegis that the people who are in it tell us it does.
So I agree with you. I agree with you. But having said that, a couple of things. First of all, Israel is one of the main proponents of the ICC, of the International Criminal Court, right? Based on the Jewish people's collective experience of the Holocaust, which was kind of the, let's say it was actually the main motivation behind the establishment of the ICC, that experience, as well as the Genocide Convention. Okay, that's, of course, the great irony here, that that very convention is being weaponized against Israel today. Now, the thing is correct. I mean, you could say, well, the countries that matter, the countries that are actually fighting wars, are not really involved, and they don't have to worry about these institutions. That's true for America, okay? But Israel isn't quite in the same league in America, okay? Israel does have other concerns. And the fact that many of Israel's friends are members of the ICC and, of course, also see themselves as being subject to the jurisdiction of the ICJ, what happens is when these bodies act in a way which is contrary to Israel's positions, and I would say in a way that goes far beyond their, you know, first of all, they go beyond their powers, but also in such a way that they're actually very taking a biased view. This creates a situation of tension between Israel's interests and these other countries. Let's take, for example, I don't have to mention it specifically, but a country in Europe. Most countries in Europe, which are generally friendly with Israel, are signed onto the ICJ and onto the ICC. Now, under the constitution of the ICC, every country that is a member of the ICC is bound to arrest a person subject to an arrest warrant of the ICC. That means, at least theoretically, that if Prime Minister Netanyahu, the Defense Minister Gallant, who now have arrest warrants against them from the ICC, if they go to a country in the world which is a member of the ICC, that country is obliged to arrest them. Now, of course, they could do a South Africa, right? An Omar al-Bashir, and not arrest them, but that puts them into a difficult situation vis-a-vis the ICC and vis-a-vis the other countries who are members of the ICC. It's not a great place for Israel to be. The ICJ, similar, even more so. There's more legitimacy to the ICJ than there is to the ICC. Remember, America is also in the ICJ. I agree that these bodies have their limitations, including the UN itself. I totally agree with that. But on the other hand, certainly a country like Israel cannot ignore the potential detrimental aspects here. They unfortunately do carry weight.
And I think, you know, David, just drawing on some of your experience because of the role that you played in terms of legal advisor with regard to Gaza, can you please just paint a picture for us in terms of some of the big items that we should be looking at and considering as we're listening to all of these proceedings and as we're watching this world stage play out?
I think what strikes me the most when I see the conversations, for want of a better word, going on around the world, on campuses, etc., in the media, etc., is that I think there's a fundamental lack of understanding or lack of knowledge, A, of the facts, and B, of the law, which applies to the situation. My background is law, so I'd like to talk about that. Just because I think it's important to understand what is the legal framework that Israel is operating in. And because Israel needs to be judged according to that legal framework, not according to any other legal framework. Okay, so Israel is engaged in an armed conflict or a war with Hamas. Now, there are two major chapters, if you like, in the law of armed conflict. The one is whether you have the justification to even engage in a war or use military force. Now, in South Africa, I know some people still learn Latin or used to learn Latin. So that's called the jus ad bellum, right? It means the the law concerning whether you can get into a war in the first place. For that, you need a justification. In our case, you know that the Israel and Hamas have an agreed ceasefire since 2021. And you know, Hamas quite clearly broke that ceasefire on the 7th of October. I don't want to go into the terrible details of that, really. I mean, we can put that aside. I'm going to just talk as a lawyer, you know, as terrible, as awful as really that was. But it's clear that Israel has a justification to defend itself against this. And remember now, it's not defending itself against a country which at any stage can just sign, you know, you can say, okay, we've had enough, we'll sign a peace agreement, let's move on. Okay, we're defending ourselves against a terror organization who declare, I mean, just about every day, that they will never make peace with Israel. In fact, their raison d'etre, their reason they exist, is to annihilate Israel. They don't deny it. I mean, on the contrary, but they say it proudly all the time.
I mean, David, yeah. not even on a basis of law. We don't have to get into that because that sounds almost academic in a situation like this. But it seems that any sensible person prosecuting a war against people who began that war with you, when you approach victory, that's precisely not the time to give it up, no matter how much international pressure there is. If you have almost achieved your goal, which is to wipe out the people who tried to wipe you out, and as you say, who have avowed to do this again and again, then you should see your job done. It doesn't matter about the war. Every war that was begun was probably begun on some tenuous reason throughout history, whether it was just, you know, conquest, acquisition of territory, some family vendetta in Europe. There are thousands of reasons for wars to exist. This seems like one of the more just reasons in human history. And it seems that since Israel's winning, they're the only country in the world that's not allowed to complete that victory, which is odd.
Right. Well, yeah. That brings me to the next chapter, right, of the laws of war, which talks about not only whether you can engage in war, but like how you engage in war, what you can actually do to accomplish your military aims. Okay. So there, it's important to note that war is a totally different moral universe to peacetime, or let's say a law enforcement situation, or anything else one might imagine. What is the main distinction in war? Legally speaking, what you can do, what you can't do in peace, right? In peace, let's just say you have the worst terrorist in the world, a mass murderer, etc., that the most you can do with that person is to arrest them, put them on trial, you know, give them rights of appeal, the rights of evidence, everything else. You know, you use the criminal law to deal with that. In a situation of war or armed conflict, the laws change. Now, I need to point out, Hamas is not a terror organization of the type which has, you know, small cells spread out in certain places, and every now and then they pop up and create havoc, which is a terrible thing in itself. But generally, the way you would deal with that is either using the criminal law, right, as I described, or perhaps what they call administrative law. In other words, you might have, you know, most countries in Europe have special legal action they can take, like even detaining a person without trial, but to prevent terrorism. But here we're in a completely different sphere. Okay, we're talking about a terror organization. But it also has the military capabilities of an army. Okay, so you have this deadly combination, which is a relatively, I mean, it's a couple of decades old, really, this phenomenon that a terror organization has the abilities of a, you know, akin to the, I mean, you know, we're talking about organizers which are, you know, militarily stronger than probably most states in the world. Okay, certainly if you want a perfect example of that's Hezbollah in Lebanon. Right. I mean, they have a rocket arsenal of 150,000 rockets. And I can count on one hand the number of countries who have that anything close to an arsenal that size. OK, this is major, major military force. Hamas is not quite Hezbollah. I think they aspire to be. OK, and obviously they've been degraded to quite some extent, but they're also a significant military force. So that means that the whole legal universe is different. We're now in an armed conflict in war. And the big distinction is that in war, you can legitimately kill combatants on the other side of the enemy. Okay, so Israel is legally entitled to target members of Hamas, people who are engaged in hostilities, okay, active people playing an active part in hostilities. That's the first rule of war. Okay, but there's the rule, but that comes along with the rule of distinction, which is at the same time you cannot target civilians. Okay, that's also very clear. Now, obviously, it'll become apparent. Hang on, what's going on then in Gaza, right? How come there are so many civilian casualties? Okay, so we don't have the exact numbers, and there's some dispute about what the casualties are. But of course, there are many civilian casualties in Gaza. I don't think that's in dispute, and that is a terrible tragedy. I mean, anyone with a conscience should be extremely, extremely bothered by that. But when we look at the laws of war, it says the following. It says, when you're going after a legitimate military target, there is the possibility that civilians or civilian objects will be affected by a legitimate attack on a military target. And then the law of war says, in that case, what applies is the law of proportionality. And the law of proportionality says, you may attack the target still, despite the risk to civilians, but, if the anticipated risk to civilians, in other words, the anticipated harm you will cause to civilians or civilian objects, would be excessive in relation to the anticipated benefit, the military benefit you would achieve from attacking the military target, then you may not attack. Okay, let me just rephrase that because that's quite a mouthful, quite a lot to take in. It basically means you have to weigh up the value of the military target on the one side. How important is it? Like a major missile which could land in central Tel Aviv and kill hundreds, right? For example, that's a classic military target, versus the number of civilians who may be in the area of that target who would be affected by if you hit the target, an explosion that would occur. You have to weigh those up. And it's a terrible, terrible calculus to have to make, okay? But that's what the law of war requires you to do. But the realization is that in situations where civilians are present on the battlefield, okay, that is part and parcel of the story. So in order to judge Israel's actions, you actually have to look literally at each and every military strike on a target. You have to first ask, well, is that a legitimate target, first of all? Is it a legitimate military target? But second of all, you have to say, okay, is the proportionality calculus correct? The next question in people's mind is, okay, well, what's considered proportionate? You know, well, how many combatants can you kill versus how many civilians? I mean, that sounds terrible, right? But that's the reality. That's the reality that we're in. So we have to make that call. Okay, I can tell you that as military lawyers, well, I'm a past military lawyer, as you know, we never really wanted to get into the numbers. Okay, it's more very much circumstantial, depending on the individual case, because it's really difficult to make hard and fast rules. What I can say for sure, that just historically and comparatively speaking, in the current phase, if you look at the number of combatants on the Hamas side who have been, well, according to Israel's count, been killed, okay, and you take that, compare that to the number of civilians who, according to Hamas's count, have been killed. Again, we don't have a better source of information. The UN, they recently came out and kind of revised its numbers because it's still relying on Hamas for its numbers.
And we found out just the other day that those numbers are complete hogwash. They're just inflated beyond belief.
No, I'm sure that is the case. I mean, I can even illustrate that to you, given a concrete example. But even with those numbers, you know, if a ratio is something like 1 to 1, okay, that is unprecedented in this kind of warfare. Now, when I say this kind of warfare, I'm talking about a situation where we're completely asymmetric in terms of abiding by the laws of war, right? Because Israel abides by the laws of war. That's why I had my previous job. Okay, because I was a legal advisor, and my idea was to ensure that you know, Israeli forces are aware of their obligations under the laws of war and apply them. Okay, on the Hamas side, they're basically that there are no rules, there are no holds barred. I mean, they break every single law. Okay, obviously the law of distinction, they attack civilians by definition. That's what they do.
Yeah.
Right? Proportionality obviously isn't even a consideration because you're already directly, deliberately attacking civilians. But also there's another side to this principle of proportionality. It says when you're defending yourself, you have to ensure that the other side, your adversary, can apply distinction, which means you have to distinguish yourself from the civilians in your environment. Okay, you can't invade yourself among civilians.
Uniform.
War crime in itself. Okay, that's human shielding. Okay, yeah. You can't do that. And so Hamas breaks, I mean, they break something. I mean, hostage taking, you know, it's a real, it's an atrocity. I mean, you know, rape as a weapon of war. I mean, you name it. Every single rule that exists in the law book, they are like sort of thoroughly breaking down. And basically, they've come to the realization, and justifiably so, that, you know, there are two ways they can hurt Israel. One is hurting us directly, like they did on the 7th of October, right? And the other way, okay, is bringing us, forcing us to respond, okay, in such a way where civilian casualties and harm to civilians is going to be inevitable because of the way they fight, right? Their modus operandi, you know, hiding among civilians, you know, hiding. I mean, they don't, you know, they wear uniform on parade, but when they fight, they don't wear uniforms, okay? Everything is by design embedded in civilians and like looks civilian. There's nothing in Gaza, you know, in active hostilities which looks military, even in the slightest. Okay, now, I mean, that's a challenge in itself to even find out where the military targets are.
So, David, that brings us then to the ICJ rulings, the original ruling, and now the, because South Africa went back to say we actually need additional measures in place. And I think that there's been a misrepresentation essentially to a lot of people in mainstream media about what exactly that ruling was. Can you talk to us a little bit about what those measures are, what the ruling has been, and where we stand today, what the expectation from the ICJ on Israel is?
You know, there was a term which I think it was coined for the first time by Henry Kissinger, right, who was the Secretary of State, who was known to be a diplomat and kind of peacemaker. And he coined the term constructive ambiguity, which is when you actually when you draft documents in such a way that they can be interpreted, you know, one way or another by the parties. And even if that doesn't solve the problem, it does enable the parties to kind of move forward. Now, this is a kind of, you know, a strange kind of twist on that. Okay, but I think that's what the ICJ has basically been doing. Okay, the ICJ is trying to have its cake and eat it. Okay, because if we take the first ruling of the ICJ, it basically said that South Africa has shown that the Palestinians have the right not to have a genocide committed against them, okay? And based on that, the court can make provisional rulings, okay? Now, South Africa, the South African delegation went home and celebrated, you know, a victory. But actually, if you read more closely, you know, I mean, the way it was interpreted in South Africa that here, the ICJ is saying that Israel is potentially committing genocide, or plausibly committing genocide. And if you remember, the retired Chief Justice of the ICJ went on the BBC and just said, I just want to clarify, that's not what we said. Okay, what we said is that that Israel has, that the Palestinians have a right not to be committed genocide against. Okay, but that's a very different ruling to that there is a plausible case that genocide is actually being committed in Gaza. So that's the first point. The second point is, if you look at all the provisional orders that were made in the first ruling by the ICC, basically they were all things that Israel agreed to in any case. There was nothing there that Israel couldn't agree to, because according to Israeli policy, all that is acceptable. You know, this idea that Israel is deliberately starving the civilian population, it's quite outrageous, and that's demonstrably untrue. Okay, you only have to look at the statistics, which are actually freely available, okay, of the number of aid trucks going in to Gaza. Now, the problem with Gaza, it's not that there isn't hunger in Gaza. There is a problem in Gaza, obviously. Okay, but who's causing that problem? That's the question. Because what all Israel can be potentially responsible for is for allowing aid into Gaza in the required quantities. Under the international law of war, it's very clear. You cannot use starvation as a weapon of war. Believe me, Israel is aware of that, okay? I need to open parentheses and say, you know, unfortunately, not all Israeli public figures, okay, are very responsible in their public statements.
Utterances.
And that, unfortunately, has been, you know, a matter of complication. But anyone, you know, but it takes a great deal of, let's say, deliberate naivety if you think that these public statements actually influence the way things are carried out. And if you want to examine the conduct of the Israel Defense Forces, you have to look at the government decisions and the actual orders that are given to the forces, okay? Not comments by a politician or a public figure here and there, okay?
But then
we're lucky living in a robust democracy, so people can say what they like, no matter how irresponsible and terrible it is. But that's
We know a little bit about that over here.
Yeah, I mean, we have a government that they just open their mouths to change feet. But either you subject yourself to this internationalist nonsense and you allow yourself to be judged by it, by the rules of supposedly Western liberal democracies, or you do what you have to do to keep your backyard clean. And a lot of that ends up being a rather dirty business. And clearly, I mean, for the average soldier in the IDF, these are concerns which they are taught and trained to observe. They know what the rules of law are. Israel has done the best job by even the statistics of people who hate Israel in trying to limit civilian casualties wherever they can. And they're fighting probably one of the more difficult kinds of war within an urban environment where there are people who are operating outside of the rules on the other side, and yet you still have to follow the rules on yours. These things make it extremely difficult for Israel to fight as just a war as the world seems to expect them and only them to fight. So a lot of this is academic to me. It's you know, the decision that a soldier has to make is completely different to the discussion that lawyers will have after the fact about whether or not that complied with clause X, Y, and Z of the Geneva Convention. And certainly those rules are not applied to the people on the other side. So I just think it's almost a shameful conversation to have at this point in the conflict.
Yeah, well, look, and the thing is that this war is also being fought in media. You know, it's not just in the theater as used to be. This is also a war that is living on TikTok and X and all sorts of social media, and polarizing, so polarizing. And when you read the judgments, which some people do, and then the media houses only pick what they want to pick. And I keep saying, bringing it back to us as South Africans and some of the conversation that has been part of the discourse here, which actually also, I think, probably had an impact in terms of voting and how some of the candidates that we were looking at, how they were questioned and where they stood and what they have to say because of the South African government's position. So this also created here in South Africa a distortion, really, and a conflation of what the rules are, what the on-the-ground situation is, and what the meaning of all of those things are. And David, you and I had a little bit of a conversation over dinner about the dissenting judgment by Justice Sebatunde, right? And I think there hasn't been enough of a conversation about that too, because it's just as important what she had to say. And she's very consistent, because even in last week's ruling, she was one of the two judges who had a dissenting view. Do you want to talk to us a little bit about that, what she said in her ruling and her position on this, which you and I agree that she probably got it right and understood what was on the table more than anyone?
I think she basically said the obvious, is that Israel is not committing a genocide in Gaza. There's absolutely no evidence of that. You know, other than the fact that people are being killed, but that happens in every single armed conflict. You know, genocide is an intentional operation to wipe out people of a certain group, you know, national or religious or ethnic group or whatever. I mean, it's patently obvious that that isn't happening, never has happened, okay, never will happen. That isn't what this is about. Now, and to even just mention that word in relation to Israel is obscene. I say obscene in particular because of the origins of the Genocide Convention, which came out of the greatest crime maybe in human history, the Holocaust against the Jews. So, so you know, that as you know, the Justice Superintendent correctly just called it as it is. And that there's no room for the court to even get involved, you know, even at the outset, just because the whole, you know, the, there's a situation in law which we call no case to answer. In other words, the one side has brought a case, and then just there's just nothing to respond that you need to respond to. And from my position, that's what happened. South Africa made a case, but there was no case to answer. I do understand people who are concerned by the humanitarian side of what's happening in Gaza. It's a terrible, terrible tragedy. You know, and I can tell you the Israelis themselves are highly concerned by it too, and very, very find it very difficult. But war is war. War is a terrible thing, and these are always aspects of war. But I want to say one more thing, Gareth. You mentioned that, you know, in so many ways it sounds like academic, you know, when people have these arguments. It is so not academic for people here. It's so close to home. Okay. When people say Israeli troops moved into Gaza, right? That sounds okay, whatever. These people are our children. Okay. These people are our fathers and brothers and sisters. Okay. Those are the Israeli troops moving into Gaza. These people are getting killed, and they're getting killed because Israel is taking such care to reduce civilian casualties. It could be much easier to deal with Gaza from, you know, remotely, from a standoff position, okay? Use far larger munitions, okay, and cause much more destruction, be much more convenient, okay? Like, certainly one of Israel's main motivations, actually sending troops in, is to keep the civilian casualty rate down as high as it is, okay? It could be so, so much higher. If we were using methods used, and I don't want to point anything out, but obviously methods that are being used in other areas of conflict or have been used in other areas of conflict, if we were using those methods, you know, the civilian casualty rates would be much, much higher, and we would have much lower casualty rates ourselves. Okay, this is so close to home. Okay, I've been to funerals of kids who were in my kids' class at school. Okay, I have neighbors, but they don't sleep at night. They haven't been sleeping at night for months because they're kids on the front line. These kids, my nephew is being in reserve duty. He goes to drama school, for goodness sake. He was pulled out of drama school, okay, and to go and fight in Gaza. Okay, these are all people just pulled out, the students in the middle of their studies. Okay, this is real, okay? This is real pain, okay? People, thousands, hundreds of thousands of Israelis are directly affected by this.
You're muted, Gareth.
Yeah.
No, I totally understand what you're saying, but, you know, appealing to me on an emotional level is not going to change the facts of this, and I'm on your side in any case. So as far as I'm concerned, the academic part of it, and what I mean by that isn't that in every war, people's children are going to war. That's obviously the case. What I'm saying is that these soldiers have the additional concern of having to apply rules before the fact and not just try and survive every engagement. And that's already hard enough. It is a very difficult job to be a soldier with all of these inputs of live events in an active military situation, and also have to consider that there are people at the UN or the ICJ who are going to look at what you've done and judge it in some sort of external, removed and clinical fashion, without the understanding of the dust and the smell and the bombs and the smoke and the bodies of a real war situation. And I think that makes it even more complicated, not less. So when I say academic, we're sitting here talking about what the jurisdiction of the ICJ is. But for a soldier going into Gaza, or even for someone in Hamas trying to fight back against that, these are not their concerns. They're not worried about what the International Court of Justice is going to say about them. What they're trying to do is survive.
Yeah. But then having said that, there's another layer here. You know, Israeli soldiers are expected to follow orders, okay? The orders given to soldiers are in compliance with international humanitarian law. They are, as I say, that's my previous job was about ensuring that. And they can be held accountable under another thing, okay? Israeli legal system, okay, is robustly independent, okay? I mean, it's proven itself to many times. I mean, it puts its own leaders, you know, we have one prime minister who did a jail time, another one who's on trial. We've had a president who did jail time. Okay, it's not a system that has any hesitation about prosecuting its own. And this legal system supervises the conduct of the military in Gaza and anywhere else. Okay, and so when there is misconduct, and there is, unfortunately, I think it's far from representing the greater picture. The greater picture you know, to the best of my knowledge, okay, is by, you know, absolutely 100%. The IDF is hardwired to operate according to international law, but where there are infractions or possible misconduct, these are like very thoroughly investigated, and if necessary, in Israel. And then, by the way, the first principle of international law, of international tribunals, is that you don't get involved if the domestic jurisdiction, in other words, the country which is where it actually took place, has its own legal system which can genuinely take care of any concerns. So if there are any suspicions of war crimes, and there are, I mean, I'm not saying there aren't, okay, but again, you know, these are taken care of very thoroughly by the Israeli legal system.
Well, I just want to add into that that if Israel hasn't realized who its enemies are, and I include the United Nations and most countries in the world who have said very clearly that they're against Israel on this, perhaps they shouldn't subject themselves to nonsense like the ICJ from here on in. Perhaps they should have learned their lesson here and no longer worry about what bodies like that have to say. Supranational bodies who are unelected, who don't necessarily have the jurisdiction they claim to have, and who are supported by some of the very worst people in the world. And by people, I mean governments that have no interest in their people, among other things, governments that themselves have their hands dirty. Perhaps Israel should realize who its enemies are and stop trying to make friends with people who obviously and objectively hate them.
Yeah. That debate is a very takes place in Israel. There are those who say we should try and play along. And some, look, I mean, there's people who point to, say, the ICJ decision. Okay, if you read it, it's ambiguous. Okay, we didn't talk about the latest decision. Okay, I didn't mention that. The latest decision, right, says on the one, it kind of, you know, you can read it as you want. You can read it as ordering to stop the operation in Rafah, or to stop it only to the extent that it's causing the genocide of the Palestinians, right? So South Africa, again, came home, celebrated. But actually, you know, if you read it more carefully, there's nothing to celebrate there. So some say maybe, you know, to have this kind of sort of this game, to play this game is actually the right way to go, because we don't want to be in a position where the ICJ, like, makes some kind of completely, categorical ruling against Israel. And then putting many of our allies in a very difficult position of having to choose between us and us.
David, thank you so much for joining us. Yeah. Is there anything you can learn at the last minute, Pums? Because we obviously people are.
I actually wanted to say that thank you very much for joining us and giving us all of this additional color, because I am quite interested and a lot of our listeners to see how this particular action has created a boon for some of the political parties going into this, because for a very, very large number of South Africans, this became such a sticking point in terms of who they were willing to support at the poll because of where they stood on this conflict. So this additional information and color also helps, I think, helps me, and I hope it helps our viewers kind of understand a little bit more around all of the things that are at play here. So thank you for coming on and chatting with us about this.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, David. I hope we'll see you again soon. Thank you. There we are. That's David Benjamin, whom Pumi met in Jerusalem. And an interesting aside, because as Pumi says, that this was used as a friend of mine posted a tweet yesterday about being in the queue at the polling station. There was an ANC tent and a DA tent, and the ANC tent had a Hamas flag in it, and the DA tent had a South African flag in it. And he said, that's all you need to know. But it has been used, and I saw people pitching up to the polls with Julius, in fact, when he went to vote in Limpopo, had a keffiyeh on around his neck, you know? So it's definitely a part of our election, whether we like it or not, and whether the politicians are foisting it on people or not, because I suspect the latter may be closer to the truth.
And whether it is actually going to yield the result that they were hoping it would yield, you know? So obviously, it became a factor, I think, in the Western Cape, which is a predominantly Muslim voting jurisdiction. I wonder if that did have a factor in terms of the ANC's, pardon me, in terms of the ANC's luck in the Western Cape. It's still early in the counting. I have there in the back, I'm looking at the screen of The Rock. The numbers, the numbers are still at like less than 1%. I think of the 23,000 voting districts, we've only counted about 300.
No, 218 of 23,293.
It's still early days. But what I am seeing Davi Scholes talk about, what I'm seeing Wayne Sussman, because they are crunching numbers. My app, for some reason this morning, hasn't been working. I've been up since about 3:30 looking at these numbers, and my app's not working. My IEC app's not working. It might just be offline. There were lots of offline issues in a lot of voting districts. Where I voted, there was also an offline issue. So we'll see what that means. But I think we're in for a very, very long day, but we'll probably only start to see color coming into what the numbers are looking like around midday today. But there's still a lot to talk about.
Yeah, just before we get into all of that with Canton, just after 7, and this is a live. Today is the 30th of May, and we are live at 6:51, in case anyone's wondering. A special just post the elections yesterday. But I'm interested, Pumi, before we get into number crunching and all of that stuff, which, I mean, we're amateurs at. Everybody in the whole world can do this. But I think we'll have some insights. We've got Canton joining us after 7 as well. But how was your voting experience? What did you actually go through? You said there were some problems.
Yeah, so I think many people remember that I had a problem with my voting station with the local general election. Mm-hmm. So this time I did the work, found out, went early I had to drive 30 minutes to get to the station where I have since been moved to. And when I arrived, it was early, it was 10 a.m., there were quite a number of people in the queue, but everyone was in good spirits. It's a mixed area, so Kensington is a very cosmopolitan and mixed area. White people, black people, pregnant people, young people. There were some young people in that queue as well. and I was in and out, I think, within 20 minutes. The only thing that wasn't working was the scanner. For the digital scan, but they had they had my ID, they had me on the voter's roll, they crossed it off, all of that kind of stuff, and got my 3 ballots. And as I told you guys, I gave my vote, I gave my national vote to the UDM, because I think that the general would do well back in, and I split my vote. I did.
Yeah. And you split your provincial.
I split my provincial and regional vote, and I split my, who did I vote for now? I split it, and I gave it to new guys. I gave it to the new guys. I gave it to the new guys. I gave a vote to Nobuntu is the provincial candidate for Busa. I quite like her. I think she's got a good head on her shoulders. And I think if she can get into the provincial parliament, she will do well. She should be in the room. Who else? Yeah. So
I am not, for the first time in any election, because I've always said who I voted for, I'm not actually saying who I voted for this time, because it seems to jinx the poor people that I've, you know, I voted for Cope once. What happened to them? I voted for Herman once, and that's not going so well. So I'm just going to shut up this time around. I'm not going to say who I'm voting for. I might reveal it at some point, but it's actually nobody's bloody business. So don't feel you have to either. But I noticed on this point of elections being a bit of a mess, and we, you know, I was very much an IEC defender up to now, and I think there was a very good point made by Kaius Tolle, who we've had on the Burning Platform a number of times, and Kaius said, we mustn't forget that the IEC's budget was cut by the government.
Yeah.
You know, they cut their budget significantly, which is ridiculous in an important election year like this. We should have all said, hold on a second, what's going on here? Why are you cutting their budget? I mean, they certainly don't cut budgets on blue light brigades and presidential protection and all of that stuff. They shouldn't have cut this budget. Maybe that's part of the problem, and the IEC were maybe doing their best. I mean, at my polling station, the people seem very professional and together, but there were long queues. My sister waited.
There were people in the queues at 11 last night. Two of my friends who decided to go later in the day, they only got home after 11 because they were in the queue for, I think, 2 hours.
Well, Patrick in the comments says 6 hours to queue. Nearly just walked away after 3 hours, but I wanted to stick it to the ANC and the DA. So obviously, Patrick didn't.
Vote for the DA.
He said national, regional, and provincial. He split. Vryheidsfront Plus. They wanted at least a government, as least a government interference as possible. Action SA provincially here in the Eastern Cape. Okay, so people were splitting their votes. I also saw Penwell, who we've had on the show a number of times. He split his vote. Between, I think, Action SA, BOSA, and
Patriotic Alliance.
Patriotic Alliance. So that a real like three-way split for him. But I mean, if you choose to reveal your voting, that's fine. We actually had a family discussion. My sister and my mom and dad and I last night. We had supper together, and everybody voted differently, which was very interesting.
So, as you know, the DA issue and voting for the DA is always so contentious here in the comments.
Yeah.
Always so contentious here in the comments. People not. So I just saw somebody say it's funny. It's interesting how people won't. Astrophysics says people won't admit they voted for the DA, but will say proudly if they voted for smaller parties because you won't be judged.
Yeah, that's right. That is true. And that was my problem when we were discussing this just the other day, Pumi, in a different program. And I said, you know, there's this funny thing around kind of liberals. And I used to say white liberals, but liberals of all colors, because it seems to be a problem. Liberal people are so terrified of being judged and being seen to be like doing the normal thing. You know, this doesn't happen with conservatives. Conservatives are like, yeah, that's what we do. Liberals are terrified of not being cool, because part of being liberal is being cool. And therefore you have to have some nuanced approach to splitting your vote. You have to have this and that. I actually voted like my aunt is like, I voted for Zaki Ahmad. I'm like, oh, for God's sake.
Listen, yeah, you know that I'm very sad for the DA because I don't think the DA is going to do so well this year. I think they're going to recede in the polls, and I actually am very sad for them in that respect. But that's what happens when you try to be all things to all people, right? Don't think people are saying they didn't vote for the DA, and when they were in the ballot box, they did, because even the 200 plus voting stations that have declared their numbers, the DA is in trouble, guys. The DA is in trouble. The MK,
The numbers. I mean, some of these MK numbers are coming through are quite significant, but we'll get into that in a second. I do want to quickly go to the studio in Johannesburg where Jack Motlanthe is sitting. I know you didn't expect to be on here. Hello, Jack.
Good morning. Good morning.
I had to come to you because I was messaging Jack last night. I said to him, did you eventually for OHM, because he was going to vote for the Organic Humanity Movement when we spoke last week. And I said to him,
yeah,
are you sure about that? And he had a change of conscience.
Seriously, like when I stood in that little box, like I just couldn't bring myself to do it. Like I looked at the ballot and OHM was there, but I was like, this feels like you're throwing it into the water a little bit. So I went a different route.
Get democracy, guys. Democracy in action.
I must be honest with you. I did not make my decision until I was actually standing in the thing. Yeah, I was standing in that cardboard box and I went, and then I put my cards there. I honestly, up to that moment, I had not thought about it enough, despite all of the conversations we've had, which shows you how for so many people we try to intellectualize your vote and we try to make it a process of elimination and knowing the manifesto.
All voting is emotional.
It's definitely a gut feeling.
Especially when we here on this platform have spent so much time intellectualizing it, right? We've spent so much time talking to all the people, giving them, giving them the microphone, letting them tell us their 10-point plan and all of this. We have spent so much time being intellectual about it. But for a lot of people, when they walk into that booth, it really is as simple as how they felt in the morning when they left their house. What they, you know, so the person who said when they arrived and they saw the DA had a South African flag and the ANC had a Palestinian flag. Yeah. And suddenly, you know what I'm saying? All of those things happen in the spur of the moment. You are moved in particular ways. And somebody says, yeah, I like to hate the DA. And I think you must understand that I am an equal opportunity hater.
Yeah, I think the real shame, quickly before, because we got to take a break here, but quickly before we break, are we going to break? We don't need to, do we?
We don't need to. Do you need coffee?
No, I'm good. I mean, we can carry on, but I want to bring Bafana and Canton and all of those guys on. So I did see a lot of people complaining about the length of the queues. I saw people saying there were bottlenecks because they have to scratch your name off with the ruler on the piece of paper. It's not an efficient system. I mean, there's some parts of it, you know, the system was offline, as you said, Pumi, in some places, which is very irritating.
Yep.
And there were people,
and also
I know,
the turnout, guys, the turnout was good.
Well, there are people I know who could not vote. They went to the voting station, found they were not on the roll for that voting station, despite all of their checking beforehand, and were not allowed to place their national vote, which didn't seem right.
National vote or regional?
I thought we were allowed, no matter where you were in the country, if you had a valid ID and you're registered to vote, you could vote nationally anywhere, right? These people were not. It was a couple that I know, the husband and wife, were not allowed to vote. And they had a kid in the car, so one of them had to go in, then the other one had to go in. Then she was
asking.
They
should have brought the kid out. It would have jumped them to the front of the queue.
Well,
I actually saw at some voting stations, like, if you showed up with your kid, that do the whole finger thing, like the ink on your kid's fingers as well. Yeah, and I mean, I that to me at least kind of shows that the kids are getting involved as little as they possibly can, but at least moving forward, they'll be a bit more excited about voting. What I noticed yesterday, though, was the conversations that were happening outside these voting stations were very interesting. Like, people would, those that were dressed in regalia and all of that stuff, they'll try to gauge what it is that you did on the inside. But truth be told, the conversations on the outside were really about, like, look, man, are you sure you did the right thing in there? You know, like, the whole secrecy about who you voted for is pretty cool in my book, because when the numbers come in, I swear there are going to be a lot of people who are going to be shocked. And the ANC is at the top of that list. Listen, this year's elections are going to shock all of us. Trust me when I say this.
Blood on the floor.
It's going to be
gladiatorial, if anything. Gladiatorial. Listen, there are places where in KZN of some of the voting districts, and I'm talking small places here, where there are probably like 500 votes that were cast there, right? Where the ANC is down 30% and MK is up 34%. There are places where the EFF isn't even showing up.
Before you start celebrating, it's early days. And I like this comment from
3% of the vote has been counted in the Eastern Cape.
From Zwakele. Zwakele says, I was harassed by the DA, ANC, and BOSA throughout the day with SMSs and recorded phone calls. So was my mother. I wasn't. I seem to have been taken off the databases, which I'm delighted about. But no one harassed me, and thank God, because I would have told them I didn't vote for you.
5 SMSs from the DA for me.
They really like
7:35. At 7:35, my phone rang, and when I answered it, against my better judgment, I try never to answer numbers I don't know, right? 083 number. I'm looking at this number. What the hell is this? Answered it, John Steenhuisen. Hello, it's John Steenhuisen. 7:35.
Did he call you personally?
I did not get a call at all.
It was a recording. Hey, man, called me personally. Hey.
I didn't get any phone calls, SMSs, none of that. What I did bump into were the foot soldiers on the street. Guys, the conversations that were happening on the streets, trust me when I tell you, right, people so are not the proclamations that people make and what they actually do in that voting booth are very different. And it's when you find people, like if people are standing in a group, if you pull one outside of the group, like just a couple of meters away from where the rest of their party affiliates are, you'll find out the truth. People will stand there and act like, yeah, no, the ANC gave us this or the DA will do this and all of that stuff. But if you have a private conversation with those people, they'll let you know, hey, man, I voted for Bosa. I didn't go with ANC. You get what I mean?
So I saw a very funny video. Someone, I think it was an EFF guy who posted it, because there's a guy in ANC regalia and he's filming himself, which you weren't allowed to do, by the way.
Inside the booth.
Ah, he's filming himself, but he's in. You don't see his face, but you see his ANC t-shirt, right? And then he crosses EFF on both.
Yep.
I mean, it shows you.
I saw this one guy. Well, there were two of them. Both of them had ANC t-shirts on. No, excuse me. They had MK t-shirts on and ANC flags from like their waist down. It was very confusing, but when you spoke to them, what you found out was they were both voting for the EFF. I do not trust what people wear and what they vote for. I think some of them went to the rally for the free t-shirt. Let's be honest, guys.
All right. Hello, Kenton. Today, how are you, sir?
Good morning, guys. I'm fit and fabulous, Kenton, as always.
Yeah. How did it feel watching this election, not being involved in it yourself?
It was actually very pleasant, all things considered. You know, last time round, it was furious tweeting and all of that kind of stuff. And of course, warding off all of the hate from Phumzile Van Dam in particular, because she seemed to at the time make it a particular campaign to single-handedly take on the ZACP. And also, let's not forget all of the other people, you know, generally who are part of the woke left. I do believe that, you know, the curse of any election around the world is liberal white women, really.
No, it's Phumzile Van Dam, and she is like a liberal white woman. I mean, that's what she is. Even if she's black, she behaves like a liberal white woman. It's funny to me, like, I was at the receiving end of her ire just because I criticized Ryza Mzansi last week, because clearly she's all over that. Okay, Kenton, you went to vote in Buklu. Any problems at your voting station?
No, except for the fact that the lines were extremely long and they lasted well into the night, in fact. So so the voting station is literally on my street. So it's a 500-meter walk straight down the end of the road. So I walked down there with two kids and a dog and took the 8-year-old into the polling booth with me so that she could mark one of the ballots on my behalf. It's probably in breach of the IEC rules, but, you know, hey, that's okay. You know, if they can find my ballot and nullify it, good for them.
Yeah, sure. You mentioned your dog. I saw a very funny post by a guy in Cape Town. He's like, hey, by now, why are these people taking their dogs to vote? Why do the dogs have a vote?
Yeah, I think it was David Bullard who said that he thought that the blind guy with the cane who was walking in with the dog was a bit much in terms of trying to jump the queue. But the guy with the cane explained to him that it was, in fact, his dog that was there to vote.
All right. So I'm afraid for anyone who's coming in for election results at this point, I mean, they've been counting since probably 11, 12 o'clock last night, where certain of the voting stations had already sent all their results in or started to count them, because some of the smaller districts, obviously, those are easy to do. You know, you only have three people in the whole of the Northern Cape, so their results should be in quite soon. But other than that...
They're the furthest. I think they've got something like 40% counted already.
I saw the ACDP guy on the news last night saying, well, you know, the The first station to file is usually Robben Island with their 20 people or whatever it is, and they vote. But only 0.94% of the voting counting is now complete, which means only 218 of the 23,000 voting districts completed. This is by no means an indication of what's going to happen through the course of the day. But at this point, the top three parties, unsurprisingly, the ANC at 53.6%, the DA at 20.26%, and the EFF at 7.79%. Again, these are well within the numbers predicted by many of the pollsters, but they're going to be some of these people whose lives, whose entire existence is predicated on predicting these numbers, that are going to find themselves trying to explain. You know how those, Pumi and Canton and Jack, you know those people who predict the end of the world, and then when the world doesn't end, nobody ever goes back to them and says, "Hey guys, you got it wrong. What do you have to say for yourself?" Because our news media are just lazy. But in this case, I want us to go and find all the predictions and actually hold these people's feet to the fire.
Like that poll that came out from ENCA, I think it was last week. That one is, those are the people we need to hunt down after this is done.
What did the ENCA poll say? I missed that.
It was actually on the show last week with Gareth and Davi and them.
Wayne Sussman. Yeah,
Wayne Sussman. There you go. Let me just
was
see
it
if I can
Wayne's
track it
poll?
Down. Yeah. And let me tell you something. At the end of the day, when the results are made official, I can't wait to rub some of these numbers in a few people's faces. Like, it's going to be a joy. Guys, listen, you know how some of these political parties have been saying that this year is our 1994? You know what I mean? Listen, I agree with them because we're about to see a new government show up in this country. Like, I don't know why, but I'm feeling very optimistic that the ANC is going to be a goner. But anyway, let me try find this poll for you guys.
You know, from your lips to God's ears is all I can say. But some of the results that have been coming in so far are kind of interesting. Pumi, I don't know if you've been tracking stuff that's coming out of KZN.
I've been talking about it.
Yeah, you know, like Midlands Pound, IFP 63%, MK 28%, ANC 6%. Tokoza Club, Upongolo, MK 52%, IFP 20%, DA 12%, ANC 9%. Guys, you can't make this stuff up.
Escort. Escort in KZN. MK 31%, DA 41%, ANC 9%. Previously, they were 37%, the ANC. EFF 2%, you know?
I'm so excited. And I just can't.
All right, let me bring on Jack. I'm going to let you get back to running things here, Jack Mutlante.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much.
Margate. Here's some numbers out of Margate, right?
Yeah.
Margate in the Ugu district, South Coast, ANC stronghold, MK 58%, ANC 31%, down from 79%, IFP 3%. ATM 2%, EFF 1%, DA 1%. The DA was
guys. I told you, Pelosi is going to save our country. I told you.
All right. Well, let's get to Bafana Modise, who's also trying to save the country in little ways. Bafana, nice to have you on. How are you?
Good morning, guys. I'm well. On your side.
Good. How did your voting go yesterday? Where did you vote?
And more crucially, has Mossad told us the result yet?
Not yet. I'm in the Wild West, in the West Rand. It went quite smooth. The beginning of the day, the queues were not that long, so I managed to go in early in the morning, did my stuff. But when I went back later with a friend, the queues were hectic. Some people are complaining about they've been in a queue for almost an hour or two, still waiting to cast their vote. But also, I must say, the IEC didn't look so much prepared for this election, how things didn't really go smooth as we had expected to be. But on my side, it was quite a short experience, nothing too hectic.
Sure. Okay, well, you've done a lot of these interviews, especially with the provincial leaders and with youth leaders. What kind of people did you see in the queues? I mean, did you see a lot of young people? Pumi remarked that she even saw one or two which is. But how many young people did you see? Because that's the thing everybody's talking about.
Yeah, I think to be honest, a fair number of young people showed up, but we still have a lot of work to do to get the young people to the polls. I saw a lot of like the 90s. Baby, I can still call them youth, but I think we were targeting the 2000s. But I got to see that you are now my generation, the 28, 20, 30, 31, 32, who for some reason they were the first time voters. I was like, what have you guys been doing all along? But in terms of the Gen Z side, there's still a lot of work to be done. But I can say that PA, for some reason, Patriotic Alliance and Action SA, they seem to be making headways into this election.
Okay, well, we'll see again. It's very early.
That's not showing up on the results so far, I got to say. So we've seen lots of ANC, lots of DA. Haven't actually, in terms of the results that have been coming in, actually checking out.
I've seen Patriotic Alliance come up in the Northern Cape.
Yeah.
I've seen...
We've got to be so careful not to judge this too early, because we've been down this road before. I know I've sat here the morning after an election, and I've been the election nerd myself, going into tiny little districts and looking at the numbers, and it can change very dramatically or it can change very gradually through the day. But you only start getting clarity over like 80% of the votes counted. Otherwise, it goes very disproportionately one way and then the other. And we know that certain districts are very good at calculating and getting their results in. Others take a lot longer. I was worried. I don't know about you guys. I was worried because three ballot papers takes three times as long, right?
But we've had three ballot papers in municipal elections.
Yes.
So you didn't think that was a contributor to why things took longer this time around? You think it was a turnout thing?
No, I think that there's definitely a turnout thing that's at play. I think that the system issues that they had was a thing. Mm-hmm. I think the number of people who were at the wrong place was also part of the thing, right? Because first you get that part of it is what took the longest. So first you've got the guy who gets your ID from you in the queue. Surname, A to M, M to, you know what I'm saying? All of that. I think all of that is what probably took such a long time. But getting into the ballot and making your decision, I don't think that's where the issue was. I think the issue really was with the offline systems that became problematic. But also, well, I think people waited. People went to the polls late. I think people didn't go in the morning. Yeah. Because they thought it would be full in the morning. People only went later in the day. And with that surge, they found themselves having to wait longer than necessary.
Yeah, exactly what happened on my side.
You must pace yourself. You must pace yourselves for things like this. You know, have coffee every 2 hours.
So Canton, Pumi, and Bafana, who are you going to be looking at? I mean, we'll be on the IEC site all day. I think everybody in this country will be, because now we've got to see whether we've actually got some progress in certain areas. What areas are you going to be looking at? Like, which municipalities, which wards are you going to zoom in on? Because that'll give you a picture of an overall trend. There's some that move quickly. There's some that have always been stalwart, dyed-in-the-wool supporters of X, Y, or Z party. So which ones are you looking at, Canton?
I'm not really looking at a ward-by-ward breakdown, but I am looking at the broad trends, particularly in terms of KZN, because that for me is going to be the most decisive piece of the puzzle. Because, you know, based on the numbers that we're seeing so far, is there the possibility of a coalition that involves MK in that province, at least? I think that that's a very strong possibility. And obviously, Gauteng is the place that we are most concerned about, because this is more than 50% of the GDP of the country is generated right here. And if the DA is able to stretch its lead, the early voting results that we're seeing so far are tilting in that direction. If they're able to stretch that lead, is there a possibility that they'll be able to end up controlling the province in coalition? I think so, based on what we've seen so far, but it's still way too early to be able to tell that. Mpumalanga is kind of interesting, by the way, because there seems to be a strong MK turnout in that part of the world. Eastern Cape, guys, you know, I've got to say this about the Eastern Cape. I think we should just, you know, like, cut off the Eastern Cape from this country, give them independence, and let them do whatever they want. Really.
Yeah. Just
you know, I cannot understand how, you know, these guys just, you know, keep going back and falling back on the same old bad habits. It's like,
I don't know what it's.
Yeah. See, there's a comment. This is what I'm talking about when it comes to some of these issues. There's a comment here from VB who says, voted in Kempton's Hood, very different experience. Wife's registered station changed to John's Park in Buccleuch, and I was at the primary school. They live in the same address. They have the same surname, mm-hmm. and yet they were at two different voting stations. This for me, is some of the stuff that...
When things like this happen, do we attribute it, as the old saying goes, to ignorance or to malice? Because sometimes people make mistakes. And, you know, you're dealing with thousands and thousands of people's names on thousands and thousands of different voters' rolls and stations and districts that have different people on them. Is it a mistake or do we think there's malice involved? Because I think it's just these things happen. And by and large, it proceeded mostly freely and fairly. There weren't outbreaks of violence, as far as I could tell. There were a couple of disputes over queues and people jumping the queue, but that happens everywhere.
Look, but Gareth, in this particular case, I suspect that a lot of people just didn't check on the IEC website in terms of where they were actually registered to vote. So the particular case that this person is talking about, I was previously registered to vote at Buccleuch Primary, which is where I voted in the last election, the last national elections. And then that ended up being changed for the municipal elections. So I suspect that a lot of us just assumed that wherever we had been registered in the past is where we were going to end up voting. And they had ended up doing some shuffling around. You see, one of the interesting things in my neighborhood is that there's been this massive complex that's been built on the corner of Maxwell Drive and Old Pretoria Road, a Baldwin property complex. And, you know, so there's probably, you know, more than 1,000 voters that simply came from that place and pitched up at my voting district, which is, you know, the nearest place to vote. And, right. You know, one could not actually anticipate that there'd suddenly be this massive number of people that were dropped into particular areas over the past 5 years. But, you know, construction in Gauteng really works at that dizzy rate where suddenly their entire neighborhoods where they didn't exist 5 years ago. I think that's got a lot to do with it.
Yeah, I think it's...
But also I think it's poor preparation. When you look at how many people actually had to move around town, they thought they were registered here. I mean, for some people, they've been voting at a particular school for all these years. Yeah. And next thing they are told that, no, we are not registered here. You must go to town or to go to another school. But like, I've never voted there before. So I think maybe the IEC could have done better with their system, because all of that contributes to why the queues were long, why systems did not work accordingly, because people were just not put in the right places. So I think from my side, I think, you know, just poor preparation from the IEC side. And even BS people can be blamed not to go to the IEC website. But I think, as you know, I live in Randfontein. I will vote where I usually vote. And when you get there, maybe after hours, you are told, no, actually, you shouldn't be here. You should go to the other side. To the voters, the problem was that most of them actually thought that the best time to go and vote is in the afternoon or after 5. And that's when millions of them thought the same thing. So that's why yesterday we had quite a long queues taking place midnight.
No, but I think that the IEC did very well. I think what we forget is that the IEC, besides the fact that their budget was cut, was that their preparation time was also cut because they were back and forth court cases, right? So they were how the independence would be on the ballot, what all of those things also, and they did flag this over and over. The IEC did flag that the amount of time they need to prepare is X. And all of that was not, nobody cared. You know, they went to Parliament and
I'm 100% with you on this point. You know, if you compare the way in which our elections were run with the way in which the United States runs their elections, you know, ours is actually absolutely smooth sailing by comparison. To your point, I think that we need to be far more active in terms of actually getting out there and checking our registration status and things like that. The forest move, but the dinosaurs remain behind.
Guys, I have an update. 5.53% of the votes are counted. That means 1,288 of the voting districts are now complete. And at this point, the ANC dipping to 43 from 50-something. EFF at 7.5, more or less the same. And the DA going up to 27%. But again, these are early days. So interesting stuff happening. But a couple of Northern Cape municipalities are starting to file their results now. As I said, there only are about 10 people in the Northern Cape, so that shouldn't take so long to do. I'm interested also in watching whether there are going to be swings that will change things in terms of the balance of power in the Western Cape. And obviously, we're all interested in the Gauteng provincial government, right?
Yes.
Because that affects us far more than the national government does in the province that you're in. If the province that you're in is run properly, and if the municipality that you're in, obviously this wasn't a municipal election, but if the municipality that you're in is run properly, then you're a happier person because that's where it affects you, where the rubber hits the road, as they always say. I'll be curious about KZN. I don't live there, but I'd like the place to run a little bit better. And I think people there are also, there's more at stake for them than there would be in places like the Free State or Eastern Cape.
We should watch KZN very carefully. KZN and Gauteng, remember that these two provinces account for something like 49% of the national vote. You know, the number of people in those two places, that's why it's so important to watch those numbers and see how those numbers do. And here's Umzinto, which is also in the Ugu district down south, MK 53%. ANC down from 75 to 34%. IFP up from 4 to 8%. EFF down from 14 to 4%. Guys, big shifts.
Yeah.
We were saying up front that a lot of the EFF vote was going to actually tilt in favor of MK because people were looking at EFF because they did not want Ramaphosa. And JZ is a far more preferable alternative to people than Julius, frankly.
Yeah, but I think the expectation would have been that the EFF on this election, they might come out high. I'm disappointed, actually, that they have dripped so low. Okay, it's not the final results yet, but one would have assumed that maybe you would see a lot of EFFing around them, filling up FNB Stadium. I mean, the guys have filled up FNB Stadium. He's been speaking very proud about how they're working the ground. So, and also a lot of young people on TikTok, they've been speaking on how the EFF is the future. So it's quite surprising how Julius is always haunted by this thing of filling up stadiums but not getting the votes as he would have hoped for.
I've always said on the show here that the two things about the EFF, I thought the EFF has plateaued quite a while ago already. Social media only has about 4 million people on it. So just because you're showing numbers on social media doesn't mean that you're going to show numbers in the... And that's what it is. You've got to get the vote out. You've got to get the vote out. One of the things that we spoke about, even with the surge of the MK, is I felt that MK can get people out. Looking at some of these districts that have been counted already in KZN, 80%. Yeah. 80% is what the turnout looks like in those districts. Because the MK was able to get people out to vote. And that's where the difference is, right? Is you've got to get people out to vote. It'll be interesting to see how some... That's all the difference. I'm very much looking forward to see as the metropole numbers come in, because in the metro areas is where you're going to see Action SA. In the metro areas is where you're going to see some of the rise, because I think they're quite strong. They were quite strong on the ground in those places. So I'm looking forward to see what that looks like too.
So three things I want us to look at here, and I suspect Canton may be able to answer this question. It's quite an interesting one about what happens in Oranje. Do they have a vote, and what do they do? Do they have like a policy in Oranje about who they vote for? And is it a ward on its own? I'm not sure. But these two things, while Canton's busy trying to figure out what the answer to that might be, this is from Rachel Colisi, which I thought was probably one of the smarter things that I saw online yesterday. I'm sick of seeing people's hideous thumbs with their very, very bad manicures and their ink stain on there. But here's Rachel. She says, best voting advice. Voting isn't marriage. It's public transport. You're not waiting for the one. You're getting on the bus. And if there isn't one going exactly to your destination, you don't stay home and sulk. You take the one that's going closest to where you want to be. I thought very, very smart. And she retweeted someone called Mohammed Safa there, which I like very much. All right. And then this, guys, the third thing, while Anthony's contemplating Oranje. Look at these nonsense.
I'm actually just searching through the voting districts to see whether they have one.
So here's a nonsense party list that I generated. So we've got all kinds of parties here. That, did you know there was a party called Citizens? CITIZA.
Yes,
I didn't have a chance to to study the ballot paper while I was in there. I was conscious that I shouldn't take any more time than was necessary. But Citizens, I mean, I thought about voting for them if they promised to teach spelling at school, but I changed my mind.
So, Samba Dick is asking, is there a magic percentage of votes counted that will give us a very close indication of how things could end? So, in past elections, I found that Davi Scholtz has a really fantastic model that he uses. He has a modeling tool that he uses, and I found him very accurate with regard to his modeling. So, he feeds all of this data coming out of the IEC polls as they're counting into his modeling tool. So if you are on X, if you're not, get on X and watch Davi Scholtz. Davi is very, very good. His modeling tool has been pretty close to accurate. But I'm telling you guys, we're only going to start seeing what those patterns look like around midday, after, like around lunchtime. Pace yourselves. Yeah. Pace yourselves. Have coffee at strategic times, because we're in for a long night. We're in for a long night, guys. We're in for a long night. It's going to be in the evening today that we're also going to be able to kind of where the metropolitan areas, where the big voting districts numbers start coming in. It's going to be later today. So pace yourself. Have coffee. Watch. Download the app.
Did you see where all the politicians went to vote yesterday? I saw Cyril went to Soweto, which he hasn't lived there for ages, but he went there. I saw Thabo Mbeki and Kgalema Motlanthe went to Kilani. I saw John Steenhuisen was in Cape Town somewhere. Julius was in Sesheho. I didn't see any of the others. I did see Paul Mashatile. I saw him casting his vote, but I'm not sure where he was. Did you see any of the others?
So here is official voting district declared by the IEC. 65% turnout. Eastern Cape, Kenton, guess what?
Tell me.
ANC, 61%.
Yep.
I don't know. Do you think
18%? MK, 10%. We must 10% in the Eastern Cape. The MK, 10% in the Eastern Cape. Guys.
Uh-huh. You know, I've been to the Eastern Cape, and it's one of the worst provinces. Not the worst, but I'm just saying less developed. And it kind of gets me worried. Why do people still vote for the ANC? Meanwhile, they are at the worst receiving end of service delivery. Is it because of loyalty to the Xhosa leaders that led the ANC?
Let me tell you something. Simpiwe, who's still producing shows for us, and Simpiwe was on record with me for the last couple of months saying she's going to hide her grandmother's ID. She's not going to tell her when voting day is. Simpiwe had to take her grandmother to the polls yesterday. Her grandmother was wearing an ANC headscarf. And when Simpiwe said to Granny, "We're not going to vote ANC," she said, "Aye, suga." And she kept winning. So people will vote who they're going to vote for. And for many people, it's not a question of new information or what everybody on social media. They've already decided that for a life, for their whole life, that's what they're going to vote and that's what they're going to do. So we can sit here and criticize all we like. Bafana, I'm going to let you go. Thank you for joining us this morning and we'll catch up soon. Canton, you look like you have something to tell us.
No, I'm actually going through right now. So I've just downloaded the Excel spreadsheet that deals with the voting districts in the Northern Cape. And yes. Scrolling through to try and get a sense of where's Orania. Yeah. And so far I'm not having any luck actually finding it on the map. So I'm assuming that it's part of a municipal district. But for the life of me, I can't quite work out. You know, the geography, of course, of Orania is kind of interesting because it actually straddles the Orange River near the Free State border.
Yes.
So, yeah, and it's kind of in the weird place. It's in the middle of no man's land. And so did the IEC actually have a polling station there? I don't know. Maybe our single Orania viewer is willing to call in at this point and tell us. So Gareth, I told you we needed that simultaneous Afrikaans translation.
Mm. Martin says it's part of the Hopetown region, so you must look maybe for Hopetown. And then Patrick says I'd also be watching the Rand as the results start to come in. Yes, because you know the guys who are really the gamblers, not the ones who are placing bets on parties, the ones who are placing bets on the currency. That'll be interesting to watch.
So Davi's Northern Cape projection, now that he's fed all of the numbers in, looks like ANC 53% in the Northern Cape, DA 21%, EFF 11%, Patriotic Alliance 8%, FF plus 3%, and MK 1%. So there's something to look out for. Just benchmark against those.
Shame. Here's Wendy letting us know that Patricia De Lille voted in Pinelands in Cape Town. Well, good luck to her and good. But
Patricia.
I saw something very funny yesterday. There was obviously a lot of, South Africans have a great sense of humor. So you've got the people saying in Benoni, they don't put ink. They just hit your thumb with a hammer. but I also saw someone said, Johan Stemmet, who used to do Noot for Noot. Someone posted a picture of him saying, Ek weet nie of Johan gestemmet nie. And then I put that up on my Instagram, and within minutes, I got a reply from somebody who was actually in the queue with Johan Stemmet.
Oh, I thought you got a reply from Johan Stemmet.
No, but from Anton, who listens to the show, and who said to me he was standing in the queue with Johan Stemmet and sent me a picture of the two of them, and hey, het gestem. So he stemmeted, old Johan Stemmet. Well done.
Oh, my goodness.
Signet doing a little search for us here. Wikipedia says under the Tembelihle municipality, that's where you find Orania. How funny.
Oh, yeah. I think I remember that from municipal elections because we were so interested. We're always interested in what Orania is doing.
Definitely. Definitely. All right. So, Pumi, which of the nonsense parties were you tempted to vote for? Citizens, maybe? Hmm? Come on.
What is that last one? Apemo.
Apemo.
It's not it's she. Shiloba. Shiloba. It's Tsonga. It's Tsonga. This is the party of Bongani Baloyi. You remember he was that DA mayor in Midvale that did so well for the DA in the Midvale and then left the DA and said he's leaving politics and then 2 months later, he showed up at Action SA, and then he left Action SA, and he started Chiloba.
Well, we'll see what happens with them. I'm not going to hold out hope. You know, I'm certainly not you know, I'm not going to expect them to be the governing party in any particular area.
Sarah's on your nonsense party list. Remember we had her, Colleen Makubela.
Didn't you vote for her nationally, Anton?
Yes, I did indeed. Yes.
So 0.00001% then.
Yeah, well, you know, like I said, you might remember our conversation, Gareth. I said, I thought that she doesn't have a hope in hell, but I'm going to vote for her anyway because it certainly resonated.
Well, guys, we've got another little update. So 8.5% of the votes are now counted. That's 1,980 of the voting districts that are now in, as opposed to just the 1,200 we had just a moment ago. And so far, it is breaking down not terribly much to the ANC's delight, because 41% of those votes are for the ANC. It keeps dropping. Of course, early days, so don't take this as the final result, unless you're an idiot. The DA 27.52, so still looking very, very strong, much, much stronger than anyone had predicted. And obviously, this is very small, 8% of the vote. But the EFF coming in third at 7.72, but immediately behind that at 7.54, MK coming in with already 44,980 votes counted.
Behind EFF.
Behind, but just behind by a ball hair. Then the PA behind that. Then the Vryheidsfront Plus, then the IFP, who've dropped down to just 1.83% of the vote.
So the people are not doing it for Sheng.
Mm-mm. No, they seem to have tended to go elsewhere. Mm.
So ANC, DA, EFF, MK. I think MK is going to overtake EFF.
It may well do that.
Numbers, I think the MK is going to overtake the EFF. Now, what is one of the things that, with the few minutes we've got left, that we should also just talk about? So we did spend a lot of time talking about coalitions and who is likely to coalition with whom in the next parliament. And I still don't believe that MK would get into bed with the ANC, but very likely could with the EFF.
And possibly even, I mean, you know, I think if MK are smart about this, they probably would keep their options open to ally with just about anyone. And we haven't heard any party say, we will not do anything with MK out of the starting blocks, have we? Canthan, there was a comment for you here about wasting your vote. Do you want to address that? This is from Carl.
I just responded to Carl.
Saying, wasting your vote. Well, yeah. Respond so that the people on the podcast can hear it.
Yeah, my logic is basically, even if she manages to scrape in with just herself as just the single seat that gets into parliament, then I think that that will be a good thing. Because certainly, of all the people that Burning Platform ended up interviewing, I think that her economic policy was most on point out of all of them. So, yeah. You know, if she scrapes through just enough to get herself into parliament, it's not a wasted vote. And, you know, the logistics of all of the signatures that needed to be collected this time round in order to even get onto the ballot, I think that, you know, if even half the number of people who ended up filling in those forms to support the formation of the party end up voting for her, there's a chance that she'll end up with a single seat, and then I'll be happy.
Well, let's see. I'm just looking at the breakdown. Obviously, Gauteng, very, very small number of votes counted so far. But what's interesting there is that the IFP are right down at the bottom. I mean, you know, if there are 2,000 votes for the DA, then the IFP has 12. So in Gauteng, I think that they're looking at really getting a hiding, even if this is just a very, very early and not particularly accurate scientific prediction.
You guys.
I have to see.
I'm quite interested to see.
Pumi?
Yeah, Pumi seems to have frozen on us.
Oh, no, I'm back. I don't know what happened. My screen just went black. But I'm quite interested to see how the Western Cape shapes up, because the Western Cape is also KZN highly contested, but it looks like the Western Cape is also a very contested space. And I think that in the last days there, you know, in the last days of campaigning, various people's campaigns were really shaping up around that Western Cape. So it'll be interesting for me to see.
I'm interested also to see whether these smaller parties, the ones that we've interviewed so many of the people from, do manage to get their one seat in Parliament. I mean, it would be great if Colleen Makubele got in. It would be great if Musi Maimane gets in, if Herman Mashaba gets in, what those people will do if they're part of the National Assembly, because that's really where they're going to be able to make a difference, if at all, right? That's where it's going to matter. Gayton McKenzie, too. I wonder how the Alliance
do. Gayton in Parliament. Ooh, guys. And the people who are not coming back. The people who are not coming back into Parliament, because we've got about 14 parties represented in our Parliament, right? So we speak a lot about the top four, which has been in the last Parliament was ANC, DA, EFF, and IFP. But there are lots of other parties like the ACDP that are represented, but very small margin sitting in there. There is the PAC was there, Al Jamaa. I keep talking about Al Jamaa because the outsized amount of media coverage on the issue of Palestine and Israel, you would think that the one big Muslim party would gain a lot of votes around this thing, but they didn't capitalize on it. I don't think that they're going to make anything. I don't think they're coming back. Good. Andipet. I don't know if Andipet is going to have enough to come back.
But I saw the saddest interview with Mosua Lekota. He was at the results center at The Rock. And I mean, the guy is just... I only laugh because I did give him my support in an election. Mm. You know, I voted once.
And Ahang was also still sitting in there with Ahang. A lone seat. Ahang's not coming back. The Musiwa Lokota situation, where did I see him? I saw him at an event. And there was a queue of people waiting to talk to him at his table. And I thought, who are all these people that want to talk to Musiwa Lokota? And I was just like, But I also don't think he's sad. He's sad. What's happened to that man? That's what happens when you age, right? He should have gotten out of politics ages ago, but here we are.
I see Vut Zarko saying in the comments, stood 9 hours to cast my vote in the Western Cape. Didn't see anyone leave you. That's very impressive. Very impressive. That's you putting
nine
in your...
9 hours!
Carl says he volunteered at his voting station and they finished counting at 2 a.m. It was well organized. Some people are going to be properly exhausted. A shout out to the Metro Cops. That's
well done, Carl. No,
good for you, Carl. Excellent. Yes.
Yeah, it's very, very good. I like that our listeners, our audience are such good citizens, you know?
Joking so. Atheist talking about a DA ANC coalition, which I think is possibly one of the worst ideas. I think it's a terrible idea, even when it was floated a couple of months ago. I think it's a terrible idea.
Common sense saying political entities must reconcile with the imperative of collaboration for the benefit of the South African populace. Yeah, well, I mean, that's better said than done because we've got egos involved and you've got people who've said, we will not under any circumstances be in coalition with these people. I think a lot of these politicians are going to have to eat their words when it comes to pragmatic decision-making around making government.
I think that people keep forgetting that we don't have two choices. It's not binary that you either go into coalition or you don't. You can have a scenario where the ANC is able to form a minority government simply based on the fact that there's enough people who will vote for a president. But then there will be specific pieces of legislation that will be rejected by the majority of the rest of the parliamentarians. And I think that's a good way to be running a country. So you don't need to have a formal alliance. You can just simply say that we're going to vote with you on these points, but we're going to abstain on other points. The EFF did that when Mashaba was mayor of Johannesburg. Yes. Of course, there was behind-the-scenes negotiation that took place there. But that was not a coalition. It was just the AFF agreed that Mashaba would be voted in as mayor at a particular point. Then they were getting ready to vote him out. And then there was some behind-the-scenes shenanigans that he would complete some stuff first and then step down. And yeah, there's no reason why we can't run the National Assembly in the same way.
A little update for you. So far, almost 10% of the vote counted. So we do have something to tell you. I mean, this is obviously, I have to put these provisos in place, otherwise people will get excited for nothing if their party's in the lead or if their party's doing very well, or they'll get upset if they see their party not doing well. So you can never gauge the election on only 10% of the vote, but we're at 9.45% complete now, so over 2,202 of the voting districts completed. And so far, the leading parties by voting district are the ANC at 41.9, but coming down again. So in all three of these updates, the ANC seems to be coming down. DA down a little bit from 27-something to 26.8%. The EFF up a little bit, going to a nice round 8% with 56,657 votes. MK also still just narrowly behind them at 7.47%, then the PA, then the Freights Front Plus, and then the IFP.
Crucial points for us are still going to be KZN and Gauteng. And those are going to be the last to come in because just in terms of sheer numbers, those are the largest, but they're the most critical for the country. Mm. And that's where the future of the country is going to be determined. You know, I'm just hoping against all hopes that the ANC gets firmly tossed out in KZN so that at least the beaches can be clean again.
Guys, even though we were so rude about COPE, even with only 10% of the vote counted, still 830 people did vote for COPE already of the counted votes. 830. Not that far behind the likes of Bossa and Rise, with just around 2,000 people voting for each of those.
How many votes for Good so far?
Good is doing better than Al Jamaa, and it's doing better than Bossa, and it's doing better than Rise so far. Good has got 2,800 votes for Good, which is 0.4% of the 10% counted so far. But they're doing better than ATM, Al Jamaa, Bossa, Rise, and the PAC. Interesting.
Have you looked at that dashboard, Gareth, of the number of spoiled votes so far?
Yes, sure. I can give you those numbers. Spoiled votes, 1.4%.
Which, you know, I think is one of the things that I was worried about, given that it's a complex ballot that we were looking at. That's a small number. It's within the margin. Hey, so I'm impressed with that.
I'm not sure if you noticed that there were a number of people who were tweeting or posting on TikTok pictures of ballots where they put an X next to the EFF and they put a foot sack next to the DA. And
spoiling their ballot.
Guys, this is a spoiled ballot because you've marked two parties and, you know, it's inherently stupid. So I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of the ballots that we end up seeing under the spoiled ballots actually are of that type.
Mm. because the absolute number, what I'm looking at on this dashboard, is 10,000 votes so far that are spoiled ballots. Yes, Gareth, you wanted to say?
Oh, so somebody in the comments asked you again to just explain where you get Davi Skoltz's projections so that they can follow them as well. And I think you said on X.
Davi is tweeting all his projections. Yeah. And I think he said he was going to be on, I think he said he was going to be on ENCA. I think that's who he's working with this time. So he just in the coverage as well, just look out for him. But he is tweeting furiously, has been since about 2 this morning.
Okay, guys, I'm going to call us to order. We've only got a couple of minutes left. We do have one last update from the IEC. 10.02% of the votes have been counted. So by no means is this a numerous clauses on the election, nor is it an indication of what might happen. But at this stage, the ANC is at 42.3%, the DA at 26.3%, the EFF at 8.1%, MK at 7.62%. And that's pretty much all the insight we can give you at this very, very early stage of the counting.
There was a question from one of our viewers around the paper ballots and is it efficient? And, you know, the interesting thing from my perspective is that you can always recount paper ballots.
Hmm.
When you've got everything in a digital ecosystem and you have machines that are capable of actually being hacked, which we've seen happen in the US.
Well, you mentioned the U.S. election, and we don't have mail-in ballots, but there were special votes for old people, for people who are working, for essential services people, for people who can't get to the polls on election day. And those
but
were
crucially, all of those require that you actually present your ID.
Yeah. And that you are physically present for them, that you're the one voting. And those happen on Monday and Tuesday. Dorian, just letting us know here, Darby's on News 24, Wayne is on ENCA. And we have, you don't have to follow these guys. You can go and look at the results yourself. Just go to elections.org.za and you can go and see the dashboard as it happens.
Yeah. Well, results.elections.org.za.
The only thing about those guys is that they're forecasting and modeling. That's the only difference.
Is
that they're kind of going, what is this pattern telling us? But yo, guys, today is going to be that day. I think it definitely is going to be a day that will be one for the ages. Just watch.
Pumi said it earlier, just pace yourself. Don't have coffee every 15 minutes or you'll be very, very tired very, very quickly. And for anybody who's going to try and get some work done today, good luck to you. Let's keep the economy going while all these other people are sitting around looking at numbers.
I think they should have had today. Today should have also been a public holiday. The one thing with some of those polling station, and I think Chris spoke about it, that they finished at 2. There might be that some people didn't get finish up the voting yesterday. And it is the call of the IEC if they're going to reopen some of those stations to let people come and finish voting. But at the moment, when I saw an interview earlier, they were still assessing what that might look like. But all in all, guys, a good voting day. No disruptions, no violence, no threats. People, millions of South Africans showed up and were allowed to exercise their democratic rights. And this, for me, is a win.
But allowed, Pumi. Who was going to stop us?
Well, that's what violence would have done, right?
Yeah.
If polling stations were closed because people were rioting outside demonstrating.
I said, you know, July 2021 told us what happens if you're going to try this rioting shit again. There's going to be stuff that's going to happen, and I think people got that message, and they've been behaving themselves.
Well, you know, there have been a lot of very funny things that people have been posting too. Just don't get so full of yourself and start to think that you're so important. Drunk people got to vote yesterday. So if they can vote, everyone can.
And prisoners. Don't forget the prisoners.
Yes, I put up a comment on Instagram. I said, I don't think prisoners should be allowed to vote. And I got just resounding support from people on that. Obviously, no prisoners commenting on it, but everyone else seems to be on my side. I don't know why we let prisoners vote. I think it's wrong.
Gareth, by the way, I must point out that I'm really enjoying the new outspoken Gareth Cliff on Twitter, which has been kind of a silent platform for you for the past few years.
I'm not exactly jumping in head first, but I'm getting wet up to just under the knees. We'll see how it goes. And I'm not put off by the likes of Phumzile Van Dam. Just by the way, on that front, I see here from Vernon, he says, what happened to Rise Mzanzi with the amount of posters I've seen? Looks like they haven't made much of an impact. We will see
what happens. I think that they're largely a metropolitan party.
What do you say, Canton?
I think that they would have ended up with lots of with a lot more votes, except for the fact that their premier candidate in the Western Cape suddenly went full tilt against white people. And a lot of the white people who would have voted for Ryaz Mzansi just suddenly said, hang on a second. Where did you come out with this race baiting stuff again? And we're going elsewhere. Simple.
Right. Okay, we're going to have to stop at that point because it is 8 o'clock. Pumi, thank you very much. Kansan, thank you very much. A special edition of The Burning Platform for you this morning on the podcast Party South Africa. Follow us, subscribe, like, do all of those things, and you will get updates as we do these shows, not just from time to time, but regularly. And The Burning Platform continues, as it always has, on the podcast Party. Make sure you are the first to find out when things are happening by subscribing, liking, get the notifications. All of that stuff. We will see you next week for more Burning Platform, and I will see you on the Real Network tomorrow at 6 a.m. Cheers, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.